thank you all for coming tonight. Tonight we welcome Dr. Amy Fahey, who speaks and writes on literature and education and the moral imagination. Her work has appeared in the Catholic Herald, Crisis Magazine, The Catholic Thing, Columbia, and other publications. She teaches literature and writing at Thomas More College of Liberal Arts in New Hampshire, and she's a graduate of Hillsdale College, the University of St. Andrews, Scotland, and Washington University in St. Louis. She and her husband, William, have been homeschooling their five children for over a decade. Tonight we'll be hearing Dr. Fahey talk about children's literature, or the role of children's literature in a digital age. So please welcome Dr. Fahey.
So I thought I'd begin this evening by with a little story time. I'm going to read you a book. It's a book that my mother-in-law, who's a librarian in Kansas, gave me. It's called It's a Book. And I thought it would set the tone nicely for our talk this evening. It's signed by the author. And it begins by introducing the characters. It's a mouse, it's a jackass, it's a monkey. Those are the three characters. What do you have there? It's a book. Do you scroll down? I don't. I turn the page. It's a book. Do you blog with it? No. It's a book. Where's your mouse? He's on top of his head. Can you make the characters fight? Nope. Book. Can it text? No. Tweet? No. Wi-Fi? No. Can it do this? He's banging the keyboard. No. It's a book. Look, he hands him the book. Arr, nodded Long John Silver. We're in agreement then. He unsheathed his broad cutlass, laughing a maniacal laugh. Ha, ha, ha. Jim was petrified. The end was upon him. Then in the distance, a ship. A wide smile played across the lad's face. Too many letters. I'll fix it. And it says, LJS, colon. RRR, exclamation point. K, question mark, LOL, exclamation point. Jim, colon. And then one of those sad faces, colon, parentheses, exclamation point, colon, parentheses, happy face. So, what else can this book do? Does it need a password? No. Need a screen name? No, it's a book. And then the jackass takes the book, and he's reading it, and reading it, and reading it. Are you going to give my book back? No. Fine. I'm going to the library. Don't worry, I'll charge it up when I'm done. You don't have to. It's a book, jackass. So, I actually don't think that's a children's book. It's a book for people like me, bibliophiles who love books, and understand that books are under assault in our culture from more exciting forms of technology. About 50 years ago, a Canadian philosopher, Marshall McLuhan, declared in his book, Understanding Media, the Extensions of Man, that, quote, the medium is the message. The change of scale or pace or pattern, he said, that a new invention or innovation introduces into human affairs becomes the message. So let's think about that and try to put the new technology into some kind of context. And those who are involved in some of the new technologies have given us some cautionary words on them. So former Facebook editor says, quote, the short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we have created are destroying how society works. One of the former editor of Wired magazine, Chris Anderson, who has five children, talks about the addictive effects of screens. Quote, on a scale between candy and crack cocaine, it's closer to crack cocaine. And then there's some statistics that are quite jarring for us. So by their teenage years, more than half of all children are on their devices for 4 hours a day. More than a quarter, that means more than 25% of all teenage children are on their devices 8 hours a day or more. 79%, so most young people, display symptoms of emotional distress when they're kept away from their personal devices for any extended period of time. So it's hard when you're on Snapchat or playing video games for that many hours a day to think about, to even conceive of, picking up a book, let alone to have the mental energy or the attention span needed to engage the printed word. So I actually don't intend to spend that much time this evening attempting to convince you of the gravity of the threat that digital media pose to our young people's encounter with imaginative literature. Because if even casual observation of what you see in young people today and the grim statistics that I've just quoted don't persuade you, I'm not sure what will. And I hope that you will agree that digital media do pose a threat, a major threat to the traditional form of reading today, namely book reading, and particularly imaginative literature. And that's what I intend to focus on this evening, the threats to imaginative literature. So the threats as I see them are first, technology and the use of digital media supplanting books, and I guess I would include even forms of book media like Kindle in a kind of, you know, in competition with the traditional form of book reading. And another threat that I see, which seems a little bit mean to take aim at, is the American library system today. And I think that's, in some respects, more pernicious than digital media because we all recognize, we all see how kids are on their devices too much. But this quiet revolution has been occurring in libraries for the past several years. And it's really decimated many of our best public libraries, especially the children's collections. And I'm not simply talking about something like drag queen story time, although I would say that things like that are certainly not helping foster healthy imaginations in young people, but a systematic and widespread campaign to remove classic children's literature from library shelves. When we first moved to New Hampshire over a decade ago, I was really excited. I had children between the ages of 10 months and 11 years, and I just felt like, oh, I'm moving to the epicenter of children's picture book writing in America and illustration. I mean, really. So many of my favorite writers and illustrators hail from New England. Robert McCluskey, Virginia Lee Burton, Barbara Cooney, E.B. White, Margaret and H.A. Ray, Dolph Ipkar, Mary Azarian, Tomi DiPaola. So when I went to the public library, I was kind of surprised to see how underrepresented many of these classic children's authors, many of them winners of the two classic awards for children's books, the Caldecott or the Newbery. Robert McCluskey, for instance, in my local library, they have One Morning in Maine, or I'm sorry, they only have Make Way for Ducklings, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with. It's set in Boston. They do not have One Morning in Maine. They do not have Blueberries for Sale. They do not have Bert Dow, Deep Water Man. They do not have Time of Wonder, which is one of my favorite books of his, Lentil, any of the other classic Robert McCluskey books. They have one. They do have the tell-all biography of Robert McCluskey about his daughter, Jane. Virginia Lee Burton, similarly. They have Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel. They do not have The Little House, which is my favorite Virginia Lee Burton book. Again, they have a biography of Virginia Lee Burton. Dolph Ipkar, and you may not be familiar with her, a Maine illustrator, wrote, you'd probably recognize her illustrations. They're sort of bright colors. The Lobsterman is probably the most famous one. The Sea Farm. If you go to any bookstore in Maine, you'll find several of them in the children's section. She died in 2017, and Publishers Weekly said this about her timeless illustrations, quote, their exquisite palette, quietly expressive figures and sublime backdrops offer an absorbing visual narrative. So my local library doesn't have any of her books. It has a book that she appears in called Women of the Pine Tree State, 25 Maine Women You Should Know. Presumably you should know her because she illustrated great books, but the library doesn't have any of the great books she illustrated, so it's kind of hard to know her. And it's not just these revered local writers who are absent from the library shelves. If you go into most public libraries in search of classic mid-century Newbery or Caldecott Medal winners, you will be similarly disappointed. One of my favorite children's books writers and illustrators is Marguerite D'Angeli. She's from Lapeer, Michigan. I'm a Michigander. I feel an affinity with her even beyond her beautiful illustrations and her beautiful stories. She did an illustrated Bible. She did an illustrated Mother Goose rhymes. She wrote books for children of all ages. She has a whole series about immigrant children, one called Up the Hill about a Polish immigrant. She wrote about Amish. She wrote about an African-American girl in a book called Bright April. She illustrated and wrote chapter books for older children. The Door in the Wall is probably the most famous, Black Fox of Lorne. When I first moved here, they had the library had several of her books. And then one day I went in and they were all gone. All of them. And I said, what happened to your Marguerite D'Angeli books? And she said, well, you know, if a book hasn't been checked out in 3 years, we're getting rid of it. And I said, well, I know I've checked it out at least, you know, several times in the past 3 years, and I know of other friends of mine who've checked them out as well. And I probed her on this policy of if it hasn't been checked out in 3 years. So Shakespeare wasn't checked out in 3 years, just check him. You know, Beatrix Potter. So there has been this, you know, effort at sort of really culling the library shelves to make way for what I'm not sure, because this library has a lot of empty shelf space now. And I haven't seen a lot of intelligent book purchasing. It's really unfortunate because in many instances, and this is, you know, verified again and again, these books are not the books you find in the library book sale. Those are books that people bring in for the library book sale. These books have been recycled. They've been put in dumpsters and recycled. And that, consequently, if you look now for a book by Marguerite D'Angeli on, you know, eBay or Amazon or any used books, the prices can often be exorbitant. So these books are truly under assault. And it is a systematic purging. There's also been a systematic purging of writers from the public memory by the American Library Association. You'll probably remember last summer, they removed the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award. The first recipient in 1954 was, of course, Laura Ingalls Wilder. And they stripped her of the book award being given in her name, because of the racial insensitivity in her books. So I don't know about you. I first read the Little House books when I was, you know, 8 or 9. And so in stripping her of this honor, they said her books generate a lot of fear. And the portrayal of American Indians, the portrayal of Native Americans and of minorities is insensitive, and it's creates this atmosphere of fear among readers. They did concede that the books could be used to educate high school or college students, but that they were inappropriate for young children, so that they could be used as a kind of what not to do when you're in high school or college. You could read them as a kind of social exercise. So, and I remember when I was introduced to these so-called inappropriate books, I wasn't a little girl in Wisconsin in a little house made of logs living with my pa, my mom, my big sister Carrie, my big sister Mary, my little sister Carrie, and my good old bulldog Jack. But I could still imaginatively enter into that world. And I loved the sense of adventure, the sense of freedom, and of danger, yes, but also of warmth and security, of family stability, of love and beauty. I just want to read to you one section from Little House in the Big Woods. Ma kissed them both and tucked the covers in around them. They lay there a while, looking at Ma's smooth, parted hair and her hands busy with sewing in the lamplight. Her needle made little clicking sounds against her thimble, and then the thread went softly, swish, through the pretty calico that Pa had traded furs for. Laura looked at Pa, who was greasing his boots. His mustaches and his hair and his long brown beard were silky in the lamplight, and the colors of his plaid jacket were gay. He whistled cheerfully while he worked, and then he sang, "The birds were singing in the morning, and the myrtle and the ivy were in bloom, and the sun o'er the hills was a-dawning. 'Twas then that I laid her in the tomb." It was a warm night. The fire had gone to coals on the hearth, and Pa did not build it up. All around the little house in the big woods, there were little sounds of falling snow, and from the eaves there was the drip, drip of the melting icicles. In just a little while, the trees would be putting out their baby leaves, all rosy and yellow and pale green, and there would be wildflowers and birds in the woods. Then there would be no more stories by the fire at night, but all day long Laura and Mary would run and play among the trees, for it would be spring. That prose has an uncomplicated beauty, just like the thoughts of a five-year-old, which Laura is at the time of the writing, have a kind of simplicity and purity of their own. And here you have this implicit hint of our own mortality in the song that Pa sings, and then this beautiful hope of new life in the coming spring. And to me, it's simply criminal that intellectuals and bureaucrats are willing to sacrifice children's experience of that beauty at the altar of identity politics. And so I would suggest, unfortunately, that the library system is another threat to children's imaginative literature. The next threat is the public educational system itself, and more specifically, the educational program adopted in New Hampshire a few years ago, known by a gross misnomer, Common Core, which is neither common nor gets to the core of what it means to be human. The huge shift, and a couple of years ago when the Common Core was still being debated in New Hampshire, I went up to Concord to address the deficiencies of the English language arts and literacy standards. So I had to read very carefully through the extensive, often EduSpeak laden Common Core documents. And it really was profoundly depressing for me. The biggest shift, of course, in Common Core is that education is solely for college and career preparedness. That's the purpose of public education, to prepare children for college and career. And consequently, imaginative literature offers very little in that preparation. And so the shift is dramatically away from any fictional works toward informational texts and nonfiction. So this is from the standards. Quote, "The standards aim to align instruction with this framework so that many more students than at present can meet the requirements of college and career readiness. In K through 5, the standards follow NAEP's lead," and that's the National Assessment of Educational Progress, "in balancing the reading of literature with the reading of informational texts, including texts in history, social studies, science, and technical subjects. In accordance with NAEP's growing emphasis on informational texts in the higher grades, the standards demand that a significant amount of reading of informational texts take place in and outside the ELA classroom. Fulfilling the standards for 6 through 12 ELA requires much greater attention to a specific category of informational texts, literary nonfiction, than has been traditional. So a high school senior now for English Language Arts has mandated that 70% of the material come from informational rather than literary sources. So one has to ask, which of our cherished local authors have been shucked to make room for informational texts on sleep patterns? Nathaniel Hawthorne, whose stories of the dangers of human pride have haunted generations of readers? Robert Frost, that cherished poet of the common people who farmed just up the road from here and wrote stirring poetry about the stone walls we erect to divide people and the birch trees we swing upon to regain our innocence? The only good tree went to mill and became a board, writes Frost in his poem entitled New Hampshire. It really saddens me, profoundly saddens me, that our school children, these beautiful trees with so much potential, are slowly but surely being turned into boards, made to buttress the crumbling edifice that is public education. And if the children are reading any fiction, it's been thoroughly sanitized to conform to the reigning dogma. And in this, we're only just behind European countries. So recently in Barcelona, the school board decided that all of the books must be checked for sexist content. And so the 600 books in the infants library, of those, 30%, 200 books, were culled. This includes all the editions of Little Red Riding Hood, all the editions of St. George. St. George is a revered local saint in the area whose feast day they celebrate, so the library had a considerable number of books on St. George. And those all had to go because they were conforming to sexist stereotypes. Quote, the type of books children read is very important because traditional books replicate gender stereotypes, and it is good to have books that break these, the head of the Parents Association told the news media. Quote, at the age of 5, children have already established gender roles. They know what it is to be a boy or a girl and what that means. So it's key to work with a gender perspective from the infancy stage. So again, with the Little House books, they said some of these books could be kept at the older grades because it was okay to read them and analyze them, and then they could reflect on the sexist stereotypes that they contain. Again, not reading them for any imaginative value, but only because you can politicize the reading experience. So there are still a handful of classic works that make the Common Core list. They're very intentional in sort of throwing a bone to traditionalists so that when they get criticism, they can say, oh, well, we still read Mr. Popper's Penguins alongside the other pernicious books that they read. But there are an increasing number of books, an increasing number, with non-binary main characters being pushed on school children. And one mother, local mother, just wrote me about a book she's battling in her son's school over. Quote, the book is titled, This Is How It Always Is. It's based on the true story of the author's own son, who now at 6 has been declared a girl. And I learned through an article in The Guardian that this author and her husband adopted their son from South Korea, not because they couldn't have children of their own. They actually don't know. They never tried. But because they could adopt and they wanted to. And she's going to be giving a reading next week up at a bookstore in Manchester. So this is just one example of the highly agenda-driven selections now prominent in schools and the gutting of imaginative literature in favor of these nonfiction informational texts and, you know, consequently, the imagination of our school children is being starved at best and polluted at worst. Really, consequently, the only thing common in this hollowed out curriculum, as Russell Kirk predicted 2 generations ago, is boredom. The last threat is book publishers themselves. Book publishers have responded lockstep to the demands of Common Core And so consequently, they've really shifted from printing imaginative literature to these information-based texts. Once popular children's books are being supplanted on store shelves by these informational works, especially at the infant and toddler stage. So informational texts for infants in picture books. These include books like Baby Loves Science, board books like Baby Loves Thermodynamics, Baby Loves Green Energy, Baby Loves Aerospace Engineering, Quantum Physics for Baby, Organic Chemistry for Baby, General Relativity for Baby. And these are not fringe books. I was at Barnes & Noble today, and those books are there, prominently displayed. And also biographies of people, board books for infants, biographies of Coco Chanel, biographies of David Bowie. There is a biography in that series of Mother Teresa, and it says on the back, she was awarded a sainthood in 2015. So as if, you know, the Holy Father gives out an annual prize for sainthood, and she just happened to win in 2015. So again, they're very clever in kind of, you know, if you were to lodge a claim, well, we have a book on Mother Teresa. There's also something that's, again, been very successful in Europe. It started in England and Ireland, but it will be here soon, no doubt. And it's called, it has this really friendly, innocuous title, Let Books Be Books. It's the Let Books Be Books campaign. It's an adjunct of the Let Toys Be Toys campaign. The Let Books Be Books campaign is to eradicate any mention of boy or girl in book titles. So you can't have the daring book for girls. You can't have the dangerous book for boys. You can't even have the body book for girls or the potty training book for boys. You can't have any books that mention anything specific, that specific about gender. Quote, do we really want them to believe that certain things are off limits for them because of their gender? They're not getting it wrong if a girl likes robots or a boy wants to doodle flowers. These artificial boundaries turn children away from their true preferences and provide a fertile ground for bullying. And so they've convinced not fringe publishers again. The first off the block to conform was Usborne Books, then Dorling Kindersley, Scholastic Books, Lady Bird, which is a division of Random House. Pretty much every major children's publisher has signed the statement, I will not publish girl and boy books. And they've even gotten the newspapers to agree, like The Independent, we will not publish reviews of gender-specific books. So, you know, if you're, you know, in a way, part of this might not be a bad thing, because if you've gone to a bookstore, you know that there are just a disproportionate number of books now that herald and promote the achievements of girls. And boys are really languishing, and that everything is packaged as, you know, girls can do anything. So if you type into Amazon, girls' books, for instance, girls' sticker books, girls' coloring books, anything. You'll get books like ABC, What Can She Be? Girls Can Be Anything They Want to Be, from A to Z. The coloring book, I Can Be Anything I Want to, Inspirational Careers Coloring Book. The sticker book, Confidence Building Sticker Book, Outdoor Sports Stickers Adventure, Science STEM Sticker Adventure for Girls. And then if you look up, and I'm not kidding, I did this today, books for boys 6 through 8, the first book that comes up is I Need a New Butt. I'm not kidding. And then there's a lot of books in the top 5 or 6 about anger management. One called Grumpy Monkey, another one called Train Your Angry Dragon. So girls get all the books about you can do anything, and boys get all the books about calm down, you're too angry. So it really is, you know, depressing. And then I'd say the last impediment to reading good imaginative literature is simply the pace of modern life, right? We're all busy. We find it overwhelming now with this everything going on to actually identify good books, let alone read them. Read them ourselves, read them to our children, read them with our children, have our children read them on their own. It was maybe about a year ago that we ordered some Pizza Hut pizza. And the box came, and the box, on the side of the pizza box, it said, read with your children. It was a little campaign, read with your children. And I thought, well, that's really good advice, but it says a lot about a culture when we're getting parenting tips and literacy promotion from a pizza box. Someone's not doing their job. So I don't want to spend any more time talking about all the bad stuff because it depresses me. And there's a lot of good stuff. So I want to talk about some of the good things and some of the ways in which I think we can creatively counter these trends. And they are pretty entrenched trends, but I think there are a number of things that we can do that I think are important. They're not easy. They require a lot of attention and constant vigilance, but I think that's where we're at as a culture. And so we can't sort of relax and assume things are going to happen just because we're good parents, grandparents, teachers, aunts, uncles. We want the best for our kids, and we provide a good, healthy home environment for them. We have to actually do a little bit more than that. And I would say part of the problem is that all of this, modern education, everything that's going on in the library system, actually only asks the question, what does society need? What does society need? You know, it's a kind of sort of Lockean enlightenment attitude toward the human person and a Lockean notion of education. Your child is, Locke had this expression, tabula rasa, a blank slate. Your child comes into the world as a blank slate, and this monochromatic secular culture is all too eager to write their agenda on that blank slate. And the earlier, the better, which is why they want to start in infancy, because they know how powerful the imagination of a young child is. But what they don't realize is that your child and every child is not a tabula rasa. As St. Paul reminds us, the law is written on all men's hearts. Every child is created in imago Dei, the image and likeness of God. Every child bears that stamp of divinity. And it is that that enables him to desire and respond to what is good, true, and beautiful. Over time, of course, if that desire is perverted rather than nurtured, the child's imagination will be corrupted and it will be co-opted. So your task then, as a parent, grandparent, aunt, uncle, teacher, sister, brother, is not to ask, what does society need? But it's asking, what does this child need? What does the human person need to flourish? And I would suggest that the human person, and our little human persons especially, and they need and they desire and they respond to stories. And I think that they need the cultivation of what Russell Kirk called the moral imagination. Russell Kirk defined following others before him, like Irving Babbitt and T.S. Eliot, identified three forms of imagination that are at work in modern culture. One is the diabolic imagination. The diabolic imagination is perverted, it's violent, it aligns with evil forces. One is the idyllic imagination, which is a kind of hyper-romanticized imagination that only refers to the self. Everything is referred through the self. And the moral imagination is anchored in timeless, unchanging truths about human nature and in the belief that man is created in the image and likeness of God. So I would suggest that our culture has been in the grip of the idyllic imagination for a pretty long time, that it's veered significantly toward the diabolic imagination, but that we can reclaim the moral imagination. And I'm just going to briefly suggest some ways we can do that. Some of them are practical. Some of them are a little bit more perhaps idealistic or just notional. One is to start a serious, intentional library, either a home library, a community library, perhaps at your child's school, perhaps at your parish, perhaps with a homeschooling group. My friend Lila Lawler has a really good resource on her blog called The Library Project. And I would say that it's an act of cultural preservation of some of these works. Sometimes I just buy extra copies because I don't want them to be destroyed. and I want to be able to pass them on to people. But if there's a good book that you love that is no longer in print, or that someone identifies on a reading list that you've seen, I suggest you try to purchase that book. If there's a book that you found that your library no longer has, I suggest that you try to find a copy of that book. I did a guest post for my friend Lila's blog at Christmas time, and I knew she has a wide readership. And so I thought, no matter what I say or what books I recommend, I better get a couple myself first, because I'm sure the price is just going to skyrocket. And sure enough, it did. and that's a good thing. But because of those Amazon algorithms, I would suggest that you coordinate your buying with friends if you're going to look for some of these classic books. Another great place to look is your local transfer station. We've gotten so many excellent children's books from the transfer station, really beautiful copies of Beatrix Potter, of classic children's illustrators, N.C. Wyeth. We got an autographed copy of Madeline L'Engle's Wrinkle in Time recently from the transfer station. Not one of my favorite books, but I looked online and it's worth a considerable amount of money. So people just, jettison their collections, and that's a great place to start. I also suggest another practical measure is, to the extent that you can, push back against the insanity at the library and at the school. Give your local children's librarian a list of good books that you'd like to order. Tell your bookstore the same thing. And it is important to engage in those immediate battles. It is. You can't get so engrossed in that, though, that you lose sight of the long view. It would be a full-time job for me to, engage in that constantly. And I say that, it's as important to have those temporary victories, to engage in the slow but constant and necessary work of fostering children's imaginations by reading with them and to them and making sure that they're reading. It would be great if the libraries could reclaim some of those collections, but if in the meantime nobody's reading anything, then it's kind of a zero-sum game. I would say that you have to be very conscious and intentional in resisting the creep of technology. I think that's fairly self-evident. That will not happen organically. There's nothing in the technology that will allow you to say, oh, I'm going to disengage now. In fact, everything's obviously engineered toward the opposite, to keep you there, to keep you in that dopamine loop. And there's a writer, Sherry Turkle. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of her, but she's published books with MIT and other publishers. One of hers is called Left to Our Own Devices, Outsmarting Smart Technology to Reclaim Our Relationships, Health, and Focus. And she writes very powerfully on the need to disengage from certain technologies and the strategies by which you can do that. I would also suggest, if you don't already, that you, again, have to be very intentional about setting aside time to read. If you don't have time to read, or if you don't have time to read to your children, then you have a problem. There's nothing's going to get solved. If you don't have time, you have a problem. You need to figure out what's wrong in your schedule that doesn't allow you to do that. And I would suggest that you, if you don't have good books, you find good books, you read good books together. I would suggest, ladies, that you read aloud, choose something to read aloud with your husbands over the summer. I think, you know, next time you're sitting down to the latest episode in your Netflix series, you know, say, you know what, I really think we could read a book together. And it's amazing what can happen when you allow yourself to slow down like that. There really is nothing like the spoken word in a story to allow you to slow down. Now, I have to confess, my youngest is 9, and my 9 and 12-year-olds, when I read to them at night, often now, I am really tired, I'm really exhausted, and I start to fall asleep. It doesn't matter how good the book is. And in fact, one of their pleasures in me reading to them at night is when I start to fall asleep. It's kind of mean, because then I start to say silly words unconsciously, and they're just waiting for that so they can howl in laughter. So sometimes when I'm reading to them at night and I know I'm going to fall asleep, I just get frustrated and I say, I'm not going to read to you anymore. You're just making fun of me. So another suggestion I have, if you find that you're short on time, you know, many of us spend inordinate amounts of time in the car, and an Audible membership is $14.99 a month, and you can get lots of good children's literature in audiobooks. Sometimes you can even find them at libraries, but certainly, you know, I've enjoyed many good books with my children. There's a great deal of, you know, the Narnia books, or the Little House books are all on audiobooks, nice audio recordings. A.A. Milne, Beatrix Potter, there's a whole host of really good recordings. Father and I Were Ranchers by Ralph Moody. I don't know if anyone's heard of that book. And then I would also suggest, you know, we're here in New England. You should, if you don't already know, learn about and promote some of these great New England writers and illustrators. And like I said, sadly, you really don't find this being done in libraries, but you do find it being done in museums because, you know, I guess people consider these writers worthy of museums. But there's a permanent exhibit at the Cape Ann Museum in Gloucester dedicated to Virginia Lee Burton, the author of Mike Mulligan and Steam Shovel and The Little House. It's actually her. She started a press, a fabric press company based on her illustrations, and it was like a guild in the region, and she got local mothers and local men and women to create designs for this Folly Cove, it was called, and it's a lovely little exhibit, a permanent exhibit. The Currier Museum, just up the road in Manchester, had a whole exhibit last summer dedicated to Tomi DiPaola and two other New Hampshire children's book writers. The MFA, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, recently had a nice exhibit of Robert McCluskey. They also had a nice exhibit of A.A. Milne. So I would suggest you keep an eye out in the local museums for children's book exhibits and, you know, pay visits to them with your children and your friends. I would also suggest, because this is often a temptation of, you know, sort of classically educated parents who want their children to have the best kind of education, who are opposed to what's being done in Common Core, I would urge you to not succumb to a kind of premature over-sophistication. So John Senior, I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, he started something called the Integrated Humanities Program in Kansas, and he was a proponent of the good books and making sure your children are exposed to the good books before they read the great books. So I was talking to a really sweet high school student recently who was telling me how bright her niece and nephew were. They were 5 and 8, and their father was reading them Dante's Inferno as their bedtime reading. And I thought, not sure what I think of that, except I do know what I think of that. And I remember telling Anthony Eslin one time, who's translated, of course, the noted translator of Dante's Inferno, that it was recommended for the fifth grade in the well-trained mind. And he said, that's crazy. That's crazy. Fifth and sixth graders should not be reading the Divine Comedy. It's too soon. And there's a danger in introducing something too soon. If you have an avid reader, there are plenty of good books. You don't need them to be reading Jane Austen at 9. You don't need them to be reading Dickens at 6. It's just not helpful. It's actually not healthy. So I understand, but I have met people who kind of overcorrect in that direction. And I would say a way not to overcorrect is to really dig into poetry. There's so much good children's poetry. And that really is an essential part of forming your child's imagination. You probably all know, because it's ingrained in my mind, in the great green room there was a telephone and a red balloon and a picture of the cow jumping over the moon. And there were three little bears sitting on chairs and two little kittens and a pair of mittens and a little toy house and a young mouse and a comb and a brush and a bowl full of mush and a quiet old lady who was whispering. So it just sticks with you, and it sticks with the child. And I can still see my favorite page, of course. What is my favorite page? Good night, nobody. Right? The blank page. And children love it because there should be something there. It's got such charming illustrations. But, you know, in an old house in Paris that was covered with vines lived 12 little girls in two straight lines. You know, we remember them because of the illustrations, but we also remember them because of the rhymes. And children, I would suggest, do as well. I had, you know, when I was doing poetry with my younger children, my girls when they were younger, there were a couple of times when I would be working with, say, a first or second grade child, and the younger ones would be sort of off in the corner doing work. But of course, they're listening. And there have been at least a couple times when it's kind of a sad poem. And there's one, Lady Moon, I remember. Lady Moon, Lady Moon, where are you roving over the sea? Lady Moon, Lady Moon, whom are you loving? All who love me. And it's about sort of the loneliness of the moon. And we finished, and I looked over, my daughter was in the corner crying. And there's another one, and it's about Odysseus, when Odysseus comes back. And it's from a great book called Mighty Men by Eleanor Fargene that basically goes from Achilles to Alfred the Great. It has little stories, and each little story is followed up by a poem. And this is the poem for Odysseus, and it's about Odysseus's dog, Argus, his faithful dog that waits, you know, 20 years for his return. Argus was a puppy, frisking full of joy. Ulysses was his master, who sailed away to Troy. Argus on the seashore watched the ship's white track, barked a little puppy bark to bring his master back. Argus was an old dog, too gray and tired for tears. He lay outside the house door and watched for 20 years. When 20 years had ended, Ulysses came from Troy. Argus wagged an old dog's wag, and then he died for joy. Which is actually what happens in the Odyssey. But it does, you know, bring tears to children's eyes. But it is formative, and it's formative in a good way. I'd say as much poetry as you can read with them, the better. I don't want to go too much longer. I also would suggest books with great illustrations. There are a lot of books with ugly illustrations these days, or sort of distorted illustrations. I'm not talking, there are whimsical illustrations. Classic illustrations are especially important today because of the ugliness that children are often surrounded by. You know, on the city streets, on the screen, in the aisles at Target. Lila Lawler says in her blog, children learn by actually conforming their senses to beautiful things. The worst thing about our present-day culture is the sheer number of ugly things our children see and hear. When a child grows up with beautiful books, he gains a high standard for beauty that will protect him from attraction to ugly things. Which is true. There's a real power to beautiful illustrations. And I think, so there's a longer debate that I won't go into now, but Tolkien on fairy stories actually advises not to have illustrations with fairy stories. And he says, because that will crowd out the child's imagination. It will give him a preformed idea of what a tree is or a river or a valley. When in his imagination, he'll have his own picture made out of all the hills and rivers and dales he's ever seen, but especially out of the hill, the river, the valley, which were for him the first embodiment of the word. So Tolkien, though, unlike Lewis in a book like That Hideous Strength, doesn't even think to ask the question, what if a child has never seen a tree? What if he's never spent time by the edge of a river? What if he's never stood at the crest of a hill and surveyed the valley below? So I actually think that we need good illustrations because they actually do the reverse. They actually create the longing for those good things in reality that they haven't yet experienced. So that when they do see a tree, they will be able to experience the beauty of the tree and appreciate it as beautiful, partially because they've seen the beautiful illustration attached to the good story. So I think the reverse is kind of true in our cultural situation that we have. So my last bit of advice is actually don't read books. Go outside and experience reality. Look down at rocks and look up at clouds. Again, John Senior in The Death of Christian Culture sort of puzzles over why young people don't really seem to get Chaucer's tale of Chanticleer. Chanticleer and the Fox. It's based on an Aesop's fable. It's uproariously funny. There's a beautiful illustrated picture book version by Barbara Cooney, which is not in my local public library. But he says that the main reason that they don't appreciate the story of Chanticleer, who's a rooster who gets attacked by a fox and then outwits him, is not because they don't understand the four temperaments that are discussed in the tale or they don't know medieval dream theory. It's because they've never seen a rooster. They've never spent time with a rooster. So I would say if you have the opportunity, it's more important for your kids to spend time with a rooster. And I think, obviously, ideally, you should do both. And that's the healthy thing. But I think having a strong connection to reality, especially in this increasingly virtual world, is the healthiest thing for a child's imagination today. And I was thinking, I'll just close with a poem by A.A. Milne from his lovely little book of poetry called When We Were Very Young, which you won't find in my public library. It's called Spring Morning. Where am I going? I don't quite know. Down to the stream where the kingcups grow. Up on the hill where the pine trees blow. Anywhere, anywhere, I don't know. Where am I going? The clouds sail by. Little ones, baby ones over the sky. Where am I going? The shadows pass. Little ones, baby ones over the grass. Where am I going? The high rooks call. It's awful fun to be born at all. Where am I going? The ringdoves coo. We do have beautiful things to do. Where am I going? I don't quite know. What does it matter where people go? Down to the wood where the bluebells grow. Anywhere, anywhere, I don't know. Thank you. Yes, Mrs. McCarthy.
So I was wondering what some of the examples where something is sad makes the child encounter something sad, mm-hmm. the daughter crying or the story about this dog. You know, Damien, my son, I have a four-year-old. He's so sensitive, and he's really lately started getting more sensitive to that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, finally, like, there's a battle, you know, who loses, and
right.
Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering your thoughts on that. Like, where do you go from there? You know, once the poem is over, the sad thing has happened, and the child is moved by it,
right?
Which is not bad, but then
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's easier, obviously, with something like reading saints' lives, which often end badly in this life. And so, I guess I don't worry as much about. I sort of let the child
just feel that.
Yeah, because they know on some level that it hasn't happened in their own life, but it gives them a framework for understanding this sadness is in reality without, you know, actually experiencing it. So that I think oftentimes there are some children who have a hard time making a distinction between something that's fictional and something that's real. So, I mean, I guess I wouldn't be tempted to say, oh, don't worry, it's only a story. But at the same time, I would think that after thinking about it, they might be able to differentiate that. Does that make sense? So, and I don't think, I mean, obviously, if you have a sensitive child and they're going to be kept up at night by something scary, I would avoid reading that. It's not fair to the child to, you know, distress them in that way. And certainly, a lot of modern fiction for children does that. It really is. I mean, just the stuff that I've seen on the shelves recently and the storylines are really kind of terrifying, but almost in a way because they are so real. So there really isn't that ability to differentiate. It's very interesting because there's a standardized test that my children have to take every year, the California Achievement Test. And there was a section in second grade that every single question was geared toward whether or not the child understood the difference between fiction and reality. So they were questions like, which of these things couldn't actually happen? The squirrels had a birthday party, like that. And I thought, this is really strange. What is this, a psychological test? I mean, what is this actually measuring in my child? And I actually think it's a result of not imaginative works of fiction, but of, you know, video games where you actually have every year two or three six-year-olds who think they know how to drive and actually take their parents' cars out because of playing Grand Theft Auto. I mean, this is, you can look online at all the stories. You know, it's kind of crazy. So there are children who have an increasing difficulty distinguishing between fiction and reality, but I actually don't think those are the children who are really, who are reading fiction. So I guess I wouldn't use your judgment, but I wouldn't be too concerned about those moments when they experience sadness reading literature. I mean, I think that's the appropriate response. So it's healthy in a way. Yes?
My kids are always devouring books. Do you have a list that we can reference and that I can pass on?
So I haven't put together my own list. I have my favorites. I don't know if you're familiar with that book, Honey for a Child's Heart by Gladys Hunt. That has a really great list. The Searcy Institute has a list of 1,000 great books on their website. John Senior put together his list of 1,000 good books. So there are really good resources for that. I think those are all good places to start. Yes.
Yeah. Like we should protect modern children.
No, I I wish there were more. And I think there's really, I think we're on the cusp of a renaissance of that. I really do. As a lot of these, you know, smaller Catholic colleges graduate, people who have great artistic skill and vision and a great love of the spoken and printed word and have a strong background in poetry and song, I think we're going to start seeing some really great efforts. There are a fair number, you know, the Catholic publishers publish certain fictional works. They tend to be more, you know, sort of exclusively Catholic or Christian and devotional. That's not a bad place to go. And they sometimes have really beautiful illustrations. So what is her name? Josephine Nobiso? The Weight of a Mass. And I can't remember the name of her other book. Margaret, what is her name? The one who did St. George and the Dragon, Margaret Hodges, is that her name? Hodges. So she has probably five or six books. Trina Shart Hyman. So there's a lot of, so there are some that are doing children's book illustration today who I would say are doing good work. I'd say it's not dead. It's, you know, sleepy, very sleepy. Yes.
So, I always liked scary stories.
You always liked?
Scary stories. And I feel like maybe at some point I got a little ahead of myself and read some too scary for my age range. What's your attitude towards scary stories? Is it what age do you think they're probably at? Is it a boy thing?
I don't know. I mean, you're talking to someone who has a very low threshold for scary books and images. I'm with Damien. I'm about that level. So I'm very careful about what I read and certainly what I watch. You know, the joke in my family is the boys and I were watching a Lone Ranger episode, and the Lone Ranger and Tonto were peeking around a corner, and a bad guy was coming up behind them, and I was sitting there jumping, you know, because I'm like, don't you see him? So I can't stand a lot of menace in books. It's just not my genre. So, but having said that, I think it's largely a temperament thing, and I realize there's a good... you know, the Michael O'Brien book, A Landscape Without Dragons, you know, where we've sanitized all the bad guys, then what's the point of that, you know? We need some good, healthy, terrifying monsters in children's fiction so that they can overcome them. So I think, you know, obviously, if you're obsessed by the violence or the terror, and not the playing out of good versus evil, then I think that that's a sign that it is too excessive. If it's causing your imagination to go there with scary images and scary, you know, I feel like sometimes, you know, scary movies really do that, even for older children, especially children who are sensitive. So I do think there's a danger to that, but obviously... there's a great, you know, Frog and Toad. Frog and Toad have a story called The Shivers, where they just sit together and read scary stories to each other so that they can get the shivers. And so there is a little, you know, there's obviously an appropriate pleasure, whatever, cathartic effect to scary fiction. But it's just, I can only stand getting the shivers at a very... I can read Frog and Toad. So... Thank you. Thank you.